Right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our program Nadia Kayali. She is a legal fellow with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And Nadia, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me on.
So we invite you to talk a bit about another Supreme Court case following our discussion of the Voting Rights Act, and that's a case called Clapper versus Amnesty International. And on February 26th, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked a lawsuit which challenged the federal government's warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens communicating with suspected terrorists and spies abroad. The 5-4 conservative court majority ruled that the plaintiffs in the case, which included attorneys and journalists, lacked standing, they said, to prove that they had been the target or will be the target of government eavesdropping. And I wondered if you could expand on the significance of this case and the involvement of your group, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
Absolutely. Well, you know, this case is a very unfortunate decision. It's going to make it a lot harder for these kinds of programs to be reviewed in the future. And what it really does is insulate secretive government surveillance from any review, because the court, as you mentioned, held that there was no standing, and so the program could not be reviewed at all. And the reason that the court held that there was no standing is because the plaintiffs couldn't show injury. In fact, in the decision, the court states that the respondents have no actual knowledge of the government's Section 1881A targeting practices. That's a section of the law that they were challenging. Now, as I'm sure your listeners can expect, it's hard to get information about secret surveillance programs, at least sufficient information to meet the standard that the court has now created.
So, obviously, we have a problem here. Some people refer to the issue of not being able to prove how the government selects surveillance targets as a catch-22, and the National Security Agency is unwilling to provide the court or the plaintiffs with any evidence or information about the program. So, really, sort of in some kind of legal limbo here where you can't prove anything because it's top secret. And this harkens back to the way the Bush administration also dealt with these challenges to their post 9/11 programs that many felt violated the Constitution.
Absolutely. And, you know, earlier in the year when the FISA Amendments Act was reauthorized, we saw that even members of Congress who were trying to get information about the FAA have been blocked. So it's really we're seeing a pretty unassailable system in place at this point. And, you know, the prospects for change, while they are grim, they're certainly still there and really are going to require pushing on elected officials more than they've seen. You know, there was not as much outcry about the FISA Amendments Act as we would have hoped.
Nadia, while the plaintiffs in this case, among them attorneys and journalists, were denied the standing by the Supreme Court, what were their concerns about surveillance and specifically about future prosecution under this program?
Well, the concerns that the plaintiffs expressed are that, you know, as you mentioned, some of them are journalists, some of them are attorneys. And so they are communicating overseas. And particularly with these changes to FISA that were passed in 2008, it's made it much easier to sweep up conversations if one end of the conversation is overseas. So it doesn't require that both ends of the conversation are overseas. If one end of the conversation is overseas, then that conversation can be picked up. And when I say conversation, I want to be clear, I'm not just talking about phone calls. I'm also talking, of course, about communication over the Internet. So emails, phone calls, Skype calls, you name it. If one end of that conversation is overseas, it could potentially be picked up under the 2008 FAA. And so they were concerned that their communications overseas could be picked up under that regime.
Now, what about prosecution, though? Is there if a journalist is talking to someone that the United States designates as a member of a terrorist organization, for instance, to get a story or insight as to what they're doing in the world, is that journalist, or in the case of an attorney, you know, working with a defendant of somewhere who's been accused of some crime related to terrorism, are they themselves under this provision of the law or other laws liable for prosecution?
Well, that's the concern, you know, is that they would be liable for prosecution. And, of course, in its decision, the Supreme Court said that that was far too speculative to grant standing. But there's really nothing to show that prosecution wouldn't be possible. And in particular, with the way that the Patriot Act has been interpreted and the way that other national security laws have been interpreted, to have such a broad definition of material support for terrorism, the concern is certainly, at least in our opinion, it's certainly not unjustified that prosecution is possible. So it's not just a fear of surveillance, it's a fear of prosecution for communication.
We're speaking tonight with Nadia Kayali. She's a legal fellow with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and we're talking about the Supreme Court case that was heard last week, Clapper versus Amnesty International, where the court blocked a lawsuit challenging the government's warrantless surveillance of citizens communicating with people abroad. Nadia, can you explain to our audience a bit about how the 2008 FISA Amendments Act works in terms of oversights and checks and balances? Who's making the decisions about those who are targeted by the U.S. surveillance system?
Well, so the FISA Amendments Act weakens the original FISA Act. So the changes that were added allow the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence to authorize jointly for a period of up to 1 year the targeting of persons reasonably believed to be located outside the United States. So this removes jurisdiction even from the FISA courts and just allows authorization of surveillance, unlike the original FISA legal regime, which did require particularized suspicion and had more judicial review. This authorizes really a mass sweeping up of communications, and so it's much broader and to a certain extent is legalizing some of those communications or some of that surveillance that you mentioned earlier under the Bush administration.
What recourse do these plaintiffs have now that the Supreme Court shut this down? Is the only way really to revise how the government is operating its surveillance system is to go through Congress? Is that the only route now?
You know, it would seem so. I mean, once a case has reached the Supreme Court, particularly because this decision was on standing and not on, you know, one of the smaller particulars of the case. If there's no standing, that really means the case can't go forward, because that's the court saying, we just, even if we wanted to, which they didn't indicate they did, we don't have authority to review this. So, you know, really at this point, it is up to elected representatives to change this law. I mean, the FAA itself, and it did, you know, unfortunately, it did just get reauthorized. There is a chance in the future to change the law. Or even, you know, even better, and this is Bill of Rights Defense Committee's position, is to affirmatively legislate, so not just to try to change the FISA Amendment Act, but to affirmatively legislate that we're not going to allow this kind of surveillance. You know, that would be the best possible solution and what we would hope that people would organize and push for.
Now, what did we learn from the dissenting justices who opposed the conservative majority that blocked this lawsuit? What did they have to say that was important to note?
Well, you know, the majority opinion really sort of ridiculed the idea that insulating this kind of program from review was a reason to hold that there was standing. But the dissenting judges actually, or the dissenting justices, sorry, actually emphasize that that is a very real concern, that this is a time when review of this program would be appropriate. And, you know, unfortunately they didn't win out, but they did feel that standing would have been appropriate.
Now, I wanted just to ask you a bit, Nadia, in terms of President Obama, as I mentioned before, and I think you agreed, there are many critics of President Obama who feel that despite the fact he ran for election in 2008 as someone who would preserve and protect the Constitution and roll back many of the abuses that were cited by critics during the George W. Bush administration, that in large part, President Obama has continued many of these same Bush-era programs. And while it's there aren't people, there aren't, you know, it didn't derail his reelection campaign, there are many people still very disturbed by this pattern, given the fact of his pledges, but also because President Obama, in his previous career, was a constitutional scholar. Maybe you could talk about that in your views here.
Well, there's no question that national security, overbroad national security policies have not only increased, I mean, they've become worse under the Obama administration in many ways. And, you know, one of the ways specifically related to the NSA and FISA, I mean, the budget of the NSA is huge. You know, recently they built a new secret facility and millions were spent on that. And, you know, this is in the wake of the fiscal cliff debates and discussion about sequestration. And Obama, under Obama, spending on national security has just continued to increase, even though this spending has been extremely high since 9/11. We haven't seen it go down, and in fact have only seen it go up. So I think that's one of the particularly concerning pieces of this, you know, obviously in addition to, without going into it in detail, in addition to, of course, targeted killings, and the continuation of other Bush policies.
It's certainly true that in many ways President Obama has exceeded the authority that even President George W. Bush claimed for himself, again referring here, as you did, to the drone program, where he and his security, his anti-terrorism advisor, make a kill list every week, and with virtually no oversight that we know about. I mean, that's quite disturbing and seems to contravene all manner of judicial or, you know, even congressional or executive processes that we're familiar with.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think most Americans don't think about, but of course, being a lawyer, I think about this a lot, is his Justice Department and the way that it has so tenaciously fought to protect his program. So this case is a good example. But another case that's percolating, you know, up and may get to the Supreme Court, of course, is the Hedges case that's challenging the NDAA. And that's another case where standing is at issue. The government is denying that there's any real prospect of injury. You know, some of what's going on is secret. And, you know, the Justice Department has just absolutely fought it. And it's also continued to use the state secret doctrine to block other cases, and, you know, it's really done everything it can to insulate, I'm not even going to call them Bush's programs, you know, to insulate Obama's programs from review and from the public eye. So I think that's been, for me, one of the particularly concerning aspects of the Obama administration.
You know, if you ask people in this country about these programs, and I haven't seen recent polling data, but I know in years past, there's been a lot of public support for these programs, the drone program in particular, the surveillance program, because they're justified by government officials as saying they're necessary to protect this country from those who want to attack us. So the whole issue of, you know, exchanging our liberty for security, you know, as Benjamin Franklin said, if you do exchange your liberty for security, you deserve neither. But it really goes to the heart of the argument. How do you respond to folks who say, hey, look, this may violate my civil liberties in some way, but that's okay with me because I want myself and my family to be safe from terrorist attacks?
Well, I think for one thing, I would say that we are actually hearing that argument less and less often, and that national security policy is becoming more and more a transpartisan issue. So, you know, it's really not just people on the left. There are very strong conservative voices that are arguing against these policies. And then, you know, to people who would say that they think they're trading safety for security, I would really point to, I think a great example is the report that came out blasting fusion centers last year that showed that these centers that are collecting information, you know, it's unclear how much information, but they're collecting massive amounts of information from pervasive surveillance of everyday life, that these centers that were created in the name of national security, that's not even what they're doing, and they're wasting, again, they're wasting millions of taxpayer dollars. So with these programs being secret, it's really a self-perpetuating cycle that we're told that they keep us safer, but we have very little evidence of that. So, you know, I would say ask for the evidence before you accept that argument. Ask for the evidence that we are actually being kept safer, that, you know, the people killed in targeted drone killings are actually responsible for so-called, you know, terrorist plots, that the people that are being surveilled under these NSA programs, that information is actually being obtained that is useful. You know, there's just so many reasons why is that dichotomy, that idea that it's national security or it's constitutional rights. I think it's really a false dichotomy. I think that I haven't seen any evidence, and most critiques of this have not seen any evidence that we're being kept safer. So, you know, where is the trade-off, really?
And I would just add that, you know, total secrecy really brings about a case of total impunity. And you mentioned the fusion centers, as you said, these kind of alliances of different law enforcement bureaus around the country that get together in these centers. You could probably explain it better than me. But from what I understand, they've collected information on the Occupy movement when that emerged in the fall of 2011, and dissenting voices everywhere are probable and possible targets for these law enforcement agencies that have been given a lot of money in the name of anti-terrorism. And we certainly saw during the Watergate era and beyond that there have been abuses when there's this kind of secrecy and lack of checks and balances. And, you know, anti-war protesters and anybody who was a dissenter during the Vietnam War era was a target under J. Edgar Hoover. And it's hard to know, really, what's happening behind the scenes in terms of that kind of targeting. But we do know that secrecy breeds impunity. And I'm curious about what you're thinking about the wider ramifications of all this.
Well, I think you just pointed to a fantastic connection. Well, an unfortunate connection, but a thing that I think people really need to think about is that what we saw during the McCarthy era and during the era right before the Church hearings, where, you know, the FBI was using Asia provocateurs. I mean, I think we're starting to see the ramifications. I think we're starting to see a country in which dissent is not tolerated. You know, that's always going to be, when you have this level of surveillance and we have this level of secrecy, and you have it going through the hands of so many elected officials or unelected appointed officials, you know, it's impossible for the end result to be anything but impunity in really prosecuting or ostracizing or just smashing opposition, political opposition. And we're already seeing it. You know, we're seeing the use of agent provocateurs in within the United States, and you know, it's certainly not going to get better if things don't change.
And the discussion that you often have with people who support President Obama, you know, unfortunately, you know, like with any politician, there are those blind followers that don't want to see any flaws. And the fact is, even if you love and worship President Obama, the fact is, you know, he's setting into a law here and precedent some very dangerous powers for the executive branch that will automatically go to the next person occupying the Oval Office, and that could be someone that you don't like very much and don't trust. So I think there's a lot of thinking we all have to do here, especially if you got some kind of blind loyalty to one candidate, one president, or the other. It's frightening what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, really some of President Obama's authority to do what he's doing came from Bush's legal team's really ingenious expansion of executive power. And Obama has just continued that. And I think that's a great point, that even if you do like him, even if you think that he really just has the best of intentions, you know, that's certainly, that power doesn't go away. It's certainly going to be carried forward. So it's really time to question that from all angles.
Well, Nadia, thanks so much for spending time with us tonight. And it would be good if you left our listeners with a way they could get in touch and know more about your group, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
Absolutely. I would encourage everybody to check out our website. It's BORDC.org. And we actually have local campaigns across the country to address some of these policies. And in addition to our website, you can also just contact us at organizing@BORDC.org. And we would love to hear from anybody who's interested in working on these issues at the local level.
Well, thanks to you and everybody there at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and appreciate you making time to join us tonight, Nadia.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Nadia Kayali. She is a legal fellow with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee.